A reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. John. There was a wedding at Cana in Galilee. Jesus and his disciples were also invited to the wedding. When the wine ran short, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Jesus said to her, "Woman, how does your concern affect me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servers, "Do whatever he tells you." Now there were 6 stone water jars there for Jewish ceremonial washings, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus told them, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim. Then he told them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head waiter." So they took it. And when the head waiter tasted the water that had become wine, without knowing where it had come from, although the servants who had drawn it knew, the head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves good wine first, and then when the people have drunk freely, the inferior wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." Jesus did this as the first of his signs at Cana in Galilee, and so revealed his glory, and his disciples began to believe in him. The Gospel of the Lord. One of the reasons why Pope John Paul II, when he gave us the 5 new luminous mysteries of the Rosary in 2002, chose the wedding feast of Cana as the second mystery of light is because it is so rich that we can continue to meditate on it over and over again every Thursday until the end of our life on earth. It reveals to us so much about Jesus, so much about his mother and the way his mother out of love intervenes for us, so much about Jesus' esteem for marriage, how he wants to take the ordinary things of life, water, and turn them into something extraordinary, wine, and very good wine. We learn about the progress of faith and how the disciples at the end of today's gospel began to believe in him whom they were already following, that there was a great growth in faith as they began to spend more time with Jesus and watch him act. But what I'd like to focus our attention on today are 2 simple lines that can easily be lost in today's gospel, but they show us precisely how the Lord wishes to work and how he wishes us to work with him. And then once we've illustrated those 2 principles, apply them to 2 tremendous tragedies that are very much in the news. The first line that I want to focus on in today's gospel is when Jesus turned to those servers and said, "Fill the jars with water." Might seem like a totally unremarkable statement to us today if we were told to fill 6 barrel-size jars with water. We'd generally just go hook up a hose to a spigot outside our home, turn on the faucet, and let the hose and the plumbing do all the rest of the work. They had no plumbing. They had no running water 2,000 years ago. So how would it have occurred? It wouldn't have been possible for them to carry those 6 stone jars down to the 1 well in Cana, which you can still visit today, from which they would have had to have drawn water. Think about if you had 6 barrels made out of stone. They would have been enormously heavy already. Maybe you could have gotten 3 or 4 guys to carry it down to the well. But if you were to fill it up with 30 gallons of water, that's another 250.5 pounds. It would have been impossible to bring those stone water jars back. The way that they would have been filled is by the servers going time and again to the well in order to come back. If they had 3 servers doing it, and let's just exaggerate and say that those servers had a ceramic container or a leather pouch that could carry 2 gallons worth of water, which is probably twice or four times more than they would have been. But let's just imagine if they had 2 gallon containers, 3 servers, it would have taken them 18 trips to get to the well and back. Even for men who would have been fit, that would have been a grueling assignment. And we would have anticipated that if they were going back and forth to that well, as soon as they had done 15 or so trips, and they saw that those huge water jars were filled almost all the way to the top, they could have said to Jesus, okay, Jesus, they're basically full, do your thing. What do you want us to do this for? But no, they went back the 16th trip, the 17th trip, the 18th trip, because the second line of today's gospel is they filled them to the brim. They carried out Jesus' command with enthusiasm. What do we learn from this in both of these two lines? In the first line, buried behind it is the fact Jesus didn't need their help at all. He who created all the heavens and the earth, all the oceans, could have just with the thought turned the Sea of Galilee into Cabernet Sauvignon. He could have easily made that well percolate with spumante by just a simple word. He didn't need them at all for the miracle. Yet, he wanted their participation. And then the second lesson is, when he called for their cooperation, they didn't give it just 80%. They didn't even give just 95%. They gave it all they had to fill those waters to the brim, even though it would have been grueling, and even though in most people's estimation, they would have already done a lot by just filling it up with a little bit to spare. We learn those two lessons for us. Jesus wants us to cooperate with him in his plans of salvation. He wants our cooperation with his miracles. Even though he doesn't need us, he wants us. That's point one. And two, we're called to cooperate with him with similar zeal to the servers in today's gospel. This wasn't a one-time thing for Jesus. When Jesus fed that multitude that was starving after listening to him preach, he could have easily created a huge feast just by pronouncing a syllable. But he didn't. He said, what do you have? And they brought to him 5 loaves and 2 fish, 5 pieces of bread and 2 pieces of fish. Not enough really to feed an average-sized family here in New Bedford. But Jesus took that, broke it, blessed it, and fed 5,000 men, probably 5,000 women with those men, probably 15 to 20,000 other kids along with them. He started with their efforts. Here at Mass, he doesn't start with grain or grapes, which he made, but he starts with bread and wine, which we pray in the offertory, which you have given and human hands have made. He wants to our cooperation intrinsically in this great continuing miracle. So those two principles, God doesn't need us, but he wants our cooperation. And then second, we're called to cooperate with great enthusiasm and 100% effort. Now let's turn to the two tragedies in the news. Since Tuesday, all of us have watched with eyes full of tears and hearts full of compassion over the enormity of suffering coming from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Already a land in which so many had next to nothing, not even what they had was spared. It was all destroyed. When I got news, I began to think of a priest I know working in one of the poorest slums in Port-au-Prince, Father Andrew Labatorio. For a few days, we didn't know what had happened to Father Andrew. But on Thursday afternoon, I received an email from somebody who had visited him. And what had happened to him in his parish, he was celebrating a daily mass at 4:30 on Tuesday afternoon. 4:53, right as the earthquake was about to hit, he was at the part of the Mass right before the words of consecration when he was saying, and on the night he was betrayed, Jesus took bread, said the blessing, and that's when the entire church started to tremble. That parish was so poor that they had never been able to build the upstairs church. They were celebrating in the basement, and the roof of that basement was made out of that same cheap, unreinforced concrete that we've seen all in rubbles over the last few days on television. So he didn't continue. He immediately got his people out of that church, which ended up crumbling to the ground. But in that email written by one of his brother priests down there in Haiti to all those who knew him, Father Andrew said that he's spending all night and day out with his 1,300 parishioners in the middle of a field with almost no food and water. And curiously, he said, "We're just praying that the Americans can come through and help us." He's not an American, but he knew that help would come from here. He was also thinking of a native daughter of our parish, Sister Alin Antil, who celebrated her 50th anniversary of religious life last summer. She graduated from our schools here at St. Anthony's and followed the vocation to be a religious of the Holy Cross. And almost in her entire religious life, she served the poorest of the poor in Haiti. She's the principal of the school in Port-au-Prince. We still haven't heard if she or her teachers or her students have made it. I'd ask you to join me in praying for her and them. It was quite natural, as we were watching those terrible images on television, for us to ask the questions that always come up with natural disasters like this. Why did some survive and others not? And occasionally we make it far more personal. Why are we still here when so many die through things like this, when so many are struck by drunk drivers, who die in freak accidents at work, who are caught on the wrong side of the road when a tornado strikes? Those are natural questions for us to ask. We'll only know the answer in heaven. Jesus won't answer it for us here. But the question we're called to ask in the face of things like that is, given that I'm alive, what am I supposed to do? Given that I'm still here, how can I help? What the Lord Jesus is asking of us now is to cooperate with him with the same zeal with which his servants in Cana did. So many of our brothers and sisters in Haiti are in desperate need, and Jesus wants us with him to become true good Samaritans for them. Few of us are doctors or emergency rescue personnel. If we were to go to Port-au-Prince, most of us would just be in the way and not really be able to help people there. But here we can, first and above all, through our prayers, but then second, through our sacrifices to help them in their immediate needs, as they so much need water and food, but also over the upcoming weeks and months, when with great assistance and courage, they're trying to rebuild their lives. Today, I'm changing the second collection. If you brought any envelopes with you for what was going to be the second collection, the Catholic Communications Campaign, which funds the Channel 6 television mass for the homebound each Sunday, please put it in the first collection along with your budget envelopes. Today's second collection is going to go straight to Catholic Relief Services, the U.S. Catholic agency that's already doing so much there in Port-au-Prince. You know, I thought it was kind of noteworthy. On Wednesday, as everybody was announcing how much aid they were sending, the Chinese government, which represents one out of every six people alive, decided that they were going to send $1 million to help in the relief effort. In Catholic Relief Services, representing us Catholics, even though they didn't have the money in their bank account at the time, immediately announced that their first installment was to send $5 million of aid, counting on God's providence and counting on the fact of the goodness and charity of Catholics in our country to be able to replenish those coffers and even allow them to do far more. None of us is able to do all that we would want to be able to do in Port-au-Prince, rescuing people from under the rubble, caring for the orphans, helping them reverently bury the hundreds of thousands of dead. But this is one concrete way, very much known by God, by which we can add our five loaves and two fish, that we can go to the well of our bank accounts and with zeal fill up not stone water jars, but collection baskets, placing these our meager efforts into the Lord's hands so that he can multiply those efforts and put them into the hands of his mystical body there on the ground in Port-au-Prince, helping to save people's lives and put their lives back together. Please be as generous as you can. It's really hard for me to say anything after that application of the gospel, but I ask you to bear with me as I focus on one other crucial tragedy in the news and what the Lord is asking of us in terms of our cooperation with his will. On Friday, we mark one of the most ignominious days in our country's history, the 37th anniversary of the disastrous Supreme Court decision Roe versus Wade that invented a constitutional right for mothers to kill their babies in the womb. Since that day, almost 50 million of our littlest brothers and sisters have perished in that sanctuary in our country alone. I want you to think for a little bit about that number, 50 million. We can hear it and it can just slide through the other ear. But the best estimates of how many people died in Port-au-Prince, it's about 150,000 fellow human beings. Those who have died in abortion in our country alone since Roe v. Wade is the equivalent of 333 of those earthquakes. Imagine if for almost an entire year, for 11 months, we had one of those earthquakes every single day. Or if you want to stretch it out over those 37 years, imagine we had something like that earthquake in Haiti every 5 weeks. That's the equivalent of what's happening in our country. There's nothing we can do, unfortunately, to stop earthquakes. We can sometimes know that they're on their way through seismic monitoring, but we have no power as human beings to stop the shifting of those tectonic plates under the earth that cause devastating earthquakes like that. But we can, and we do have the power, to stop the man-made equivalent of those earthquakes happening so routinely in our country. And the Lord wants us to work with him to do just that. If we start exercising our political will to save the lives of the unborn just as frantically as we're working in Port-au-Prince to save the lives who are buried under the rubble, we will make an enormous difference. The first thing God's asking us to do is this week, tomorrow, or as soon as we can, to act on the specific summons of the successors of the apostles of his son to call or email our Congressman Frank and our two senators, Kerry and Kirk, and ask them in this reconciliation that's going on for our health care bill to eliminate any language that would force every single one of us to pay for abortions. In the bulletin, there's specific language to use. There's the telephone numbers. There's the email addresses. Please take some time to do just that. Think about what is happening down there. They're requiring us to pay for women to destroy their babies. We need an overwhelming response to let them know that genuine health care, genuine medical care, includes saving people's lives, and if we can't, helping people die with dignity, it never includes killing innocent babies. If all 60 million of us Catholics stood up and behaved as Catholics, there is no way that would ever pass. The second thing comes on Tuesday, which is the day on which we have a special election to elect our next senator. The only way that the Senate was able to pass that part of the health care reform that would force all of us to fund the killing of innocent babies is because they got exactly 60 votes. They needed at least 60, and they got exactly 60. And those 60 were all 58 Democrats and the two independents. On Tuesday, we have an election in which the positions of the two main candidates are totally opposite with respect to that vote. Martha Coakley, our Attorney General, says that she will vote in favor of forcing us to fund abortions. And the other major candidate, Scott Brown, promises to vote against that provision, as well as against the present health care bill as a whole. They also disagree about a lot of other abortion-related issues, which the Voters' Guide of Mass Citizens for Life, which I've reprinted in the bulletin, makes clear. These differences are obviously important for every Catholic to consider in prayer before God when determining which of the candidates would best represent you and your Catholic values. A lot of the times we can say our vote doesn't make that big of a difference. In this case, it's going to make all the difference in the world. If Massachusetts voters send Martha Coakley to office, we're going to be funding abortions, unless there's some other means that stops that Democratic majority from passing something with this poison kill pill associated with it. Or if we vote for Scott Brown, it appears that we'd be able to stop that evil part of that legislation. I need to add something else about Martha Coakley, very much in the local news. On Thursday, she was down here in New Bedford and appeared on Ken Pittman's radio program on WBSM. On that program, in the midst of a short conversation, she brought up what has been one of her main campaign points over the course of the last 2 months, that Scott Brown, as a state senator up on Beacon Hill, he put in an amendment trying to protect Catholic and pro-life hospital workers, those in emergency rooms. There was a bill up there that was mandating that in emergency rooms, rape victims would need to be given a pill that, if they had conceived their baby, would kill their baby, a chemical abortifacient pill. Scott Brown, unfortunately, supported that bill as a whole, but he at least recognized that Catholics shouldn't be forced, at the risk of losing their job or criminal penalties, from having to do it. So he put this amendment that would exempt those with problems of conscience from having to participate in an abortion in an emergency room. That amendment ended up being defeated. But Martha Coakley has made that one of the real parts of her campaign. And she brought it up on the radio program with Ken Pittman because it's one of her stump speeches. And Ken, not missing a beat, said, "But Martha, do Catholics working in emergency rooms not still have religious freedom? What about the consciences of Catholics who believe that this is wrong?" Martha's response, none of us should forget. She said, "Well, yes, I suppose that there's still religious freedom in emergency rooms, but I guess Catholics shouldn't be working in emergency rooms." This comes from a woman who, by the way, claims that she's a Catholic. Think about that response. Catholics shouldn't be working in emergency rooms. She doesn't know the first thing about history. The hospital system in the United States was built by the Catholic Church and then copied by others. The rich always had private doctors, but the poor had nothing. And so the Catholics, coming from Catholic places in Europe that had built hospitals there too, started to build hospitals here. So many women religious built these hospitals from scratch, and they staffed them as doctors and nurses. What Martha Coakley is basically saying is, no longer should nuns be able to work in this charitable care in emergency rooms. If they have any qualms at all in killing innocent babies, however they were conceived, they don't belong there. I guess Catholics shouldn't be working in emergency rooms, she said. Now, I need to ask you to think, does someone with this warped sense of values, with these elemental, colossal mistakes on basic right and wrong, could somebody like that ever really represent you in Congress. Ever. Think about the Catholic nurses and doctors and pharmacists you know. Do you want them to make a choice between doing what's right or losing their jobs? Because that's what's on the way. That's what the Senate health care bill requires. And it shouldn't surprise us if someone who wants to force Catholic nurses and doctors and pharmacists to have to participate in abortions, that she would have no qualms about forcing me and Cardinal Sean and Bishop Coleman and every single one of us here to pay for it. As much as she wants to talk about choice, she doesn't want us to have any choice whatsoever to stay totally out of the evil atrocity of abortion. We have several nurses here in our parish. One came to see me about a month ago. She had her job downsized, but then she's been trying to apply for other jobs. She's a nurse practitioner. And she's had some interviews, and they've specifically asked her, will you prescribe these pills? And she said, no, I can't do that as a Catholic. And she hasn't been able to find a job. When you go to vote on Tuesday, please picture in your mind the Catholic nurses, pharmacists, doctors that you know, because your vote will have an immediate and direct impact on their livelihoods. And I would ask you also to think of the faces of all those unborn little brothers and sisters whose very lives depend on you. They have no voice. They have no vote. But we're supposed to respond like Isaiah at the beginning of today's first reading. For Zion's sake, he couldn't be silent. For Jerusalem's sake, he couldn't be quiet. And for the sake of the voiceless unborn, we shouldn't be quiet either. We need to speak up with one voice and say, no more, no more. And on Tuesday, we have a chance to do just that. I want to be clear. I am not opposing or endorsing any candidate in Tuesday's election. IRS regulations prohibit me from doing that during a religious ceremony. What I am doing, though, is vehemently opposing, on the grounds of our Catholic faith, the Attorney General's evil support for the destruction of innocent human life and the trampling of the consciences of Catholic medical personnel and pro-life citizens. Asking you directly on behalf of Almighty God to weigh this as you weigh the moral decision you have to make this Tuesday. None of us on our own can stop the evil of abortion, but together, this week, we can do a lot. Let us do our part with the zeal of the servers in today's gospel and put our efforts into the hand of the Lord, who will do the rest. Today is a week on which we Catholics are summoned by Almighty God to act as Catholics. As we receive him who says to us again today, this is my body given for you. Please remember that that is the model for our life, and it couldn't stand in any starker contrast to the diabolical motto of the abortion movement that doesn't say, this is my body given for you, but says, my body, my choice to kill what's growing inside. God help us.